All right, thank you very much for your very warm welcome, and thank you to Ron Haberfield for a very hospitable knee in the groin when I walked in. Loved your work. Why does a young guy from Mount Gambier get interested in a place like North Korea? Why is it so interesting? Well, for one, it's a Cold War relic. You know, the Berlin Wall might have come down in 1991, but in Northeast Asia, the Cold War is very much alive and well. It's got a totalitarian system, political system in place, although it's quite eroded now, but this again is a relic. It makes it an interesting place to study, although not that interesting for the people that live there and have to live under such a brutal regime. It's interesting because it's a wannabe nuclear weapons power. It does have a nuclear capability at the moment, although the degree of this capability is still a matter of debate. And it's also interesting because, as we can see on the picture there, there's been a leadership transition in the last few months. And it's headed by a young man who's much younger than me, in his late 20s, called Kim Jong-un. And the stability of this country under this leadership transition is, again, it's a question for debate. And finally, it's also an interesting place to study and to visit because it's there, because of all these reasons, because it's such a closed shop, because it's called the Hermit Kingdom. And what better reason do you need to pique your interest? So in today's talk, I'm going to briefly introduce you to how I came to become interested in Korea, talking about some of my travel experiences in South Korea and China, and for a limited time in North Korea. Which has brought me to where I am today, as North Korea is my primary research interest. And I'm happy to field some questions at the end as well. Oh, can we have someone on the clicker? Unfortunately, I left my remote in my office today, so we're going to have to get some help.
Well, he's remote, you're not taking down the line, are
you? Just the right arrow, thanks, Steve. Yep. So I first went to Korea, to South Korea, not knowing a single thing about Korean culture, about the division of the country. But I left from my first trip in 2002 with a deep passion for the place and with lots of friends. So when I can hear the heartfelt thoughts you had for your exchange student that passed away, I can relate to that because I too have really deep and fond friendships with people there in South Korea and China. There's some things you can't learn just by studying. You have to go to a place, you have to go in country to learn about a culture, to learn about its history, and to learn about and interact with the people. And one of the great things about doing that is that when you come home, you can share that knowledge and that experience with other people who've been there. Thanks, Steve. So the first trip I did was to South Korea in 2002. I went on an undergraduate exchange for a semester to a city called Daegu, which is unfortunately is not on the map. It's a bit further south from the bottom of this slide, but it's South Korea's third largest city of about 2 million people. Steve, thanks. On this first trip, I realised, coming from a position of ignorance, that South Korea and Korea in general has a really vibrant culture. It has some great spicy food. It's really influenced by Confucianism, much more so than China, which was surprising to me. I found out that it was a united political entity for a millennium leading up to 1945, which is the longest period of political unity of any country in the world up to that point. I found out that the man depicted in this statue here in the middle of Seoul, King Kojong, invented an ingenious phonetic writing system, which is the Korean script that we know today, which is not a pictographic script like the Chinese system, but is in fact a phonetic alphabet that you can learn in a week, and it's very easy. The fact that you can read it, though, doesn't mean you understand what it says, but that's beside the point. Thanks. I learned about Korean social customs. For me, South Korea was materially very similar to what I was used to in Australia and what we're used to in Western countries. But culturally, it was another universe, and I found this really difficult to deal with at first. Dealing with the Confucian age-based hierarchy was something, coming from Australia, that I had no familiarity with. And as we can see in the picture here, this is the now deceased Kim Jong-il, leader of North Korea, with South Korean leader of the time, Kim Dae-jung, at their first historic summit in 2002. Now, what's interesting about this picture is the way that Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean leader, is shaking hands with the North Korean leader, showing respect, shaking with two hands, because Kim Jong-il is older than him. And this age-based deference of respect is something that permeates all social interactions in Korea, and it takes some getting used to. Thanks, Steve. I also learn about Korean nationalism and the deep passion that Koreans have for their country, an intense national pride. But I also found out that this national pride can be quite insular and it can be xenophobic. But again, when I learned about the history of the country, I could see that there were reasons for that. Korea had been the plaything of great powers for centuries. It's often called a shrimp wedged between two whales, between China and Japan. You've also had the Russians intervening there from time to time. And in the last 60 years, you've got the Americans who've had an interest in the Korean Peninsula as well. So Korea has a long, tragic history, and you can see that in the nationalism of the country, in the way Koreans think about themselves. It's a wounded nationalism. However, I was there in 2002 at a wonderful time for South Korea, when the country really came of age, and it happened because of the 2002 FIFA World Cup, where the South Korean soccer team made it all the way to the semi-finals. And for the Korean people, this showed them that they could match it as a country with the rest of the world. And it was really a coming-of-age party for the South Korean people, and that was a positive side of Korean nationalism. And I was lucky enough to share in that experience at the time. But as I said earlier, that enthusiasm's tempered by the fact that the Cold War hasn't finished in South Korea. Now, this is a fence outside the building which you see was at the time the Korean Ministry of Defense, with the word freedom is not free, and many of you will have heard this phrase talked about before, that to be free, you need to invest in the defense of that freedom. And that's something, that's a spirit, a martial spirit that's very much alive in South Korea today. And I saw that in my Korean friends, the males who'd done their 2 years of compulsory military service before going to university. And they had some really interesting stories to tell about their experiences patrolling the DMZ or being stationed on boats that would patrol around in the Sea of Japan. But it's also important to note that part of this is the fact that South Korea until 20 years ago was an authoritarian country as well. So their experience with democracy is also quite new. This photograph is of a famous statue not far from the previous photograph. And this depicts two brothers. And this is a very famous story in Korea, of two brothers fighting for North and South during the Korean War, who in the midst of battle ran into each other and embraced as fighting was going on behind them. And this really, for me, symbolises the tragedy of Korean history, particularly in the last 100 years. In 2004, I went to China to teach English in a place called Dandong, which is right on the Yalu River, on the China-North Korean frontier in Liaoning province there. So I taught English there for a few months, and it's a very interesting place. This is the Yalu River you see here, looking across the river into North Korea, into the town of Shinwaeju. On the right, you can see the remains of a bridge that was destroyed by American bombers during the Korean War. And on the left is the current bridge, which has a rail link and a road which links China with North Korea. And it's the main trade artery across the border between China and North Korea. Interestingly, General Douglas MacArthur, during the Korean War, proposed laying a strip of cobalt along this river frontier to prevent the Chinese from intervening in the Korean War. Unfortunately, his plan to drop 26 atomic bombs across this area did not come to fruition. It's a pretty extreme story. But this is the proposal that he put forward to Harry Truman at the time. During the Korean War, China's links to North Korea were described by Mao Zedong as close as lips and teeth. Today, not quite so much. Although China is North Korea's main economic partner, the Chinese do get irritated with the North Koreans' perceived lack of respect for Chinese primacy and the fact that they do silly things like detonate nuclear weapons and conduct missile tests without due consideration for the wishes of their neighbours. Thanks. As you can see here, looking across the Yalu, this is not a militarised frontier. Contrary to in the south, where you've got the demilitarised zone, which is the most fortified frontier on Earth at the moment, the Yalu River at Dandong is more of a tourist spectacle. And indeed, you see these boats collecting groups of tourists, and they go as far as they can to the other side of the river, so you can have a peek into the Hermit Kingdom. And again, there's lots of people that went there just like me because it's there, because they can have a look and it's so tantalisingly close. The usual view of North Korea we get is that the regime is a monster. It's run by a monster. It's run by a government that is irrational, prone to doing silly things. But what I like this picture for is that it shows just some ordinary North Koreans having a swim in the river on a hot day. And for me, I really connected with this because these are just people, ordinary people, just like me. And it gets past the dehumanising view that we usually get in the popular press about North Korea. This also displays the power of karaoke. Now, has anyone here done karaoke in their time? I didn't like it. It was painful, but I did it, and I got something out of it. And what I got out of it was this guy. His name was Tony, was his English name. He was a student of mine. But I found out on this night, while getting hammered and singing along to Beatles songs, that he was also a day trader across the border in North Korea. And he told me all kinds of stories about his experiences trading in North Korea and about his interactions with people there. And he taught me about the underground entrepreneurialism that's bubbling up in North Korea underneath the totalitarian architecture of the state, which is a really interesting perspective. Later on, when I was doing my PhD studies, I was lucky enough to get some funding for a research trip in South Korea in 2008, which I spent in Seoul, the South Korean capital. And I got to interview numerous academics, journalists, and government officials on this trip, which was a really enlightening experience. This is a view of the South Korean capital from Seoul Tower. Now, this is a hill in the middle of the city, and it looks like this 360 degrees around the panorama. This city is huge. There's 23 million people live in this place. It's incredible. This is also a really cosmopolitan city. It's a great place to go. But then you think this place is also only 40 kilometres from the DMZ, and if the North Koreans wanted to, they could flatten it with artillery and missiles without too much notice. It's indefensible strategically, which is why the United States and South Korea don't really have any great military options for dealing with North Korea, because it's Russian roulette with the South Korean capital. But what this also symbolises is this is very new. The Industrial Revolution in South Korea has happened in the last 50 years, a process that took 200 years in the West. So you've had huge economic, social and political changes in a very short time in this country, which also produces, and please excuse the profanity in this slide, but I didn't write it, so it's okay. This encapsulates some of the displeasure, particularly among young people, about the rapid pace of change in South Korea. Now, this is a really interesting perspective too. It raises questions about identity, particularly older people who experienced the Korean War, who are very grateful to the Americans for helping them out, versus young people who have experienced a whole lot of built-up grievances against the Americans and don't see North Korea as much of a threat because they haven't done anything serious to the South for a while. It raises questions about the past, about families who may have collaborated with the Japanese government during the Japanese occupation, or people who might have been labelled as communist sympathisers under the right-wing authoritarian regime in the South. Or it might be people who were what you would regard as criminals during the authoritarian period, who tortured some of these so-called leftists. These are all live issues at play today in the South. Thanks. So what you get is a mix of old and new. The food you see there is a typical Korean spread where you get a lot of nibbly food and you just peck away at it. And it's a very social way to eat rather than just having a big pile of food on your plate. Peck away, have a chat, drink some soju, which is the Korean national drink. And yeah, it's a wonderful way to spend your time. Interestingly, you may have seen a food called kimchi, which is spicy pickled cabbage. It's Korea's national dish and it's said to be one of the five healthiest foods in the world. So check it out. I guarantee most of you won't like it. I don't really like it either. But it's worth trying once in your life. And again, here we see this mix between the old and the new. This is a traditional Korean drumming band that were just playing on the road in the centre of downtown Seoul when I came across them. And if you get a chance, hearing Korean drumming, it's fantastic to listen to. Really great rhythms. They really get into it. But again, it's in the surrounds of this modern hypercity of Seoul. Modernity mixed with tradition. This is a baseball game that I went to while I was in Seoul, and this is emblematic of the American occupation of the country. This is not an easy thing for Korean people to address. On one hand, it's very good. There's a lot of cultural goods that have come out of it, including baseball and basketball and all these great American cultural exports that we've got here too and that lots of people love. And there's also gratitude for the role that the Americans have played in defending the South over a long period of time. But then there's the bad. There's the cultural insensitivity of some of the American troops that are stationed there and the absolutely stupid things that they do. There's a status of forces agreement between the South Koreans and the Americans that American military forces aren't tried or aren't bound by the local law. So you can see that when Americans break the law and do something against a South Korean person, there's a feeling of injustice because there's no legal redress there. And again, it's not one thing, but it's a series of small incidents that people experience over a long time that build up into quite a hefty grievance that exists at the moment. So the future of the American-South Korean alliance is one of debate again. It's a very interesting thing to look at. While on this trip, I got to visit the demilitarized zone just north of the city of Seoul. And you go there on a day tour and you have to wear very nice clothes because you will be seen by North Korean troops and North Korean officials on the other side, and the Americans and South Koreans want to present the image of affluence on the other side. Everything is an ideological battle on this frontier. So this here is the peace village of Panmunjom. It's on the border. The actual line is between those two blue sheds. And you can also see another group of tourists on the other side who are probably a group of Chinese visiting and doing exactly the same thing as we were on this side of the line. Yep, next slide. This is within one of those sheds. This is the actual negotiating table where negotiations take place between North and South Korean officials. And when Julia Gillard was in South Korea, I think it was last year, you would have seen vision of her sitting at this table, having a meeting, having a photo op. The group of trees you see in the foreground there, that's the actual demilitarized zone. It's a real wilderness now because no one's been in there for 60 years. So it's heavily mined. Fortunately, the animals don't set them off. Apparently, they know where they are and don't step on the mines. But yeah, it's become something of a wildlife preserve. What you see on the other side is the world's biggest flagpole on the North Korean side in the propaganda village, it's called. It's called Kijongdong. Now, the South Koreans built a big flagpole, but in some kind of phallic envy, the North Koreans had to build an even bigger one, and that's what we get. The concrete buildings in the foreground of the village are just concrete shells. They've been built there to provide the illusion that this is a prosperous place, but there's nothing in them. This is a North Korean border guard, as the photo taken from the room that that table was in. And you can see the little concrete slab in the right bottom corner. That's the actual borderline between the two countries. And both sides get their biggest, burliest, angriest looking military personnel to be the border guards. Because again, they're all trying to prove a point and show how tough they are. Not far from here is the Dorasan railway station, and this is on a railway line that runs from Seoul into North Korea to Pyongyang. But of course it's closed, this railway is not operational. And this railway station's kitted out like a modern international airport. It's a very impressive facility, built more in hope than anything else that this will one day eventually turn into a modern trade artery. And you can see the idea. This is within the railway station, and this railway line's meant to link up through North Korea with the Trans-Manchurian and Trans-Siberian railways so that you can freight goods from Europe all the way to Japan by rail rather than having to sail around the world. Yep, thanks. Now, this is my one experience of actually going into North Korea. And this is, again, this is on a day trip across the border into the city of Kaesong, the ancient royal capital of North of Korea. But what we have here now, thanks, is a joint venture industrial facility run by the South Korean and North Korean governments, where South Korean companies like Hyundai, like Samsung, and you know, all the names that you're familiar with, invest in factories and so forth, and it's the workers are all North Koreans. And the North Korean government gets a hefty cut out of this, so it's a good wage earner for the North. The South Koreans are hoping that this will be a way of infiltrating capitalism into North Korea. The North Koreans are very careful about making sure that that doesn't happen. So this is a focal point of interaction. How are we going for time?
Good.
We're
out.
We're out? All right. Okay, well, we'll draw to a close there. Other than to say, yes, I will be returning to North Korea in June and July this year for a trip. It'll be my first time extended visit into the country. And Roger's kindly invited me to come back and talk about my experience in the country later in the year, which I'm really enthusiastic about doing. So thank you for listening to me today. I hope you enjoyed it. Oh, yes, we do.
I thought so. I know we're behind time now and there are a few people who need to leave, but has anyone got a question for Ben, just while we're here?
Just a comment.
Yeah.
3 years ago, we were on another French exchange in Sweden, and we stayed with a former diplomat, and Sweden was the only place that had diplomatic relations with North Korea, and he had a bottle of wine that had been given to him by the new leader, which I think would be one of the few people in the world that probably has one of those.
He hasn't drunk it, has he?
He's drunk something, but I don't know what it was like.
You would be going to.
Well, I've had Chinese wine and it's rubbish, so I can't dread to think what North Korean wine's like.
They make spirits too.
They're
rubbish too.
They are.
Nicole, did you have a quick question?
Yeah, just with your visa process for North Korea, is that easy to get? Or?
Yeah, because you're going through an official tour.
Yeah.
Okay. Then they sort it out for you. They don't stamp your passport, they just give you a...
You're on an official tour. Okay.
Yeah.
They don't know you've been there.
Yeah, but it's a fully chaperoned tour, so there's people watching you all the time, and it's expensive because you're paying for someone for your minder as well. So you don't just go in there and cruise around, it's very monitored, yeah.
Very good.
Trusting
yourself. Thanks, Ben.
No worries, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll look forward to when Ben comes back.